This is Wealth Wake Up on KGMI with Dick Donahue.
The opinions voiced in Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investment may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial, or tax advisor prior to investing. Securities and advisory services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA, SIPC. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, a registered investment advisor. LPL Financial is under separate ownership from any other named entity. Guests of Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue are not affiliated with LPL Financial, CWM LLC, or Asset Advisors LLC.
Welcome to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you here on KGMI. Big government causes slow growth. In 1930, Pluto was declared the ninth planet. In 2007, it was demoted to dwarf planet status by astronomers after considering new evidence. There are now only eight planets. Also in the 1930s, the idea of John Maynard Keynes came to age. In spite of a massive amount of evidence that these ideas don't work, unlike astronomers, economists won't demote Keynes' theories in the dustbin of history. This isn't that surprising. Whether Pluto is a planet or not doesn't impact politicians or their constituents. If it did, Pluto might still be categorized as a planet. Keynes thought a free market economy should be managed, in fact, needed to be managed. His ideas flourished in the 1930s when the U.S. was in the Great Depression. Keynes believed that a lack of consumer demand was the culprit to economic problems, and government should spend to help boost jobs and economic activity. To this day, in the name of Keynes, economists and politicians support stimulus spending, unemployment benefits, minimum wages, and the redistribution of income. Not only do politicians and bureaucrats get to increase the size of their budgets and take credit for benefiting constituents, but they get to do it in the name of helping the overall economy. They do it in the name of Keynesian economic theory. But there is no evidence it has worked. Keynes' theories, as mentioned earlier, have been around for over 80 years. Countries all over the world have tried them. Government budgets have increased dramatically. The spending encompasses food stamps, welfare, unemployment benefits, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, ethanol, solar, wind, and electric vehicle subsidies. State and local governments have boosted the minimum wage and created special subsidies and income support for citizens. Other countries have single-payer health care systems and even bigger budgets relative to GDP than the United States. But there's no economic nirvana anywhere. And after 80 years of growth in government and little economic growth to show for it, doesn't anyone think we ought to stop and question the underlying assumptions that support these Keynesian policies? Since the current expansion started, U.S. real GDP has expanded at just 2.1% annualized rate. At the same time, government spending, tax rates, and regulations have increased. These government burdens reduced entrepreneurial activity, jobs, income growth, and push companies out of the United States. But many ignore this correlation between bigger government and slower growth. Instead of blaming government, there are endless non-government excuses for slow growth. Some blame demographics. Some blame weak investment by companies. Other explanations include income, inequality, foreign trade, the residual effects of the financial crisis, or of government debt levels which result from low tax receipts. All of these explanations shift the blame to the private sector for slow growth and support Keynesian big government policy. Unfortunately, the government is funded by taxing incomes and profits of businesses activity or borrowing the wealth generated by that activity. It's true that government can help create a positive environment for business by, for example, enforcing the rule of law and contracts. But the U.S. long ago surpassed the pro-growth level of spending. The point is, government doesn't create wealth. The private sector does. No matter what Keynesian theories say, it's a truth politicians and bureaucrats don't find very appealing. Okay, this week in review, we saw U.S. retail sales disappointed. So December U.S. core retail sales were flat. China reports 2016 export drop. U.S. businesses' optimism soars. World Bank projects modest 2017 growth uptick. Global equities extended gains this week as U.S. financial firms kicked off the fourth quarter earnings season with solid results. U.S. 10-year Treasury note yields were steady at 2.42%. West Texas Intermediate crude dipped to $53 a barrel from $53.90 a week ago, and global Brent crude dropped to $56 a barrel from $56.90. The Chicago Board of Options Volatility Index, or VIX, was steady at 11.20. So U.S. holiday sales disappointed. We'll get more of that a little bit later. But U.S. retail sales rose 0.6% in December, were flat when excluding automobile and gasoline sales. And China exports fell for the second year, and persistent weakness in global trade, the possibility of disagreements with the United States over trade, does not brighten the outlook for 2017. In 2016, exports fell 7.7%, while imports slid 5.5%. There were some bright spots, discernible, suggesting that domestic demand is improving. Record amounts of oil, iron ore, copper, and soybeans were imported in 2016. And the outlook is upbeat for small businesses. The National Federation of Independent Businesses termed the jump in its small business optimism indicator stratospheric, as the number of business owners who expect better business conditions jumped 38 points. The index rose to 105.8, its highest level since 2004. The increased optimism is leading to more business activity, such as capital investment, according to the group. And the global economy is to expand 2.7%, says the World Bank. So despite stagnant global trade, subdued investment, and heightened policy uncertainty, the World Bank expects global growth to expand at a 2.7% rate in 2017, up from 2.3% in 2016, a post-crisis low. Hope for fiscal stimulus from the U.S. could generate fast growth, the bank said, though it cautioned that trade protection could have adverse effects. And President-elect Donald Trump held a press conference this week, but did not lay out a clear theme or timeline or framework for tax cuts and regulatory reforms he campaigned on. Markets are growing concerned that stimulus could come later than expected or be smaller in size than was first envisioned. Trump did say that the Affordable Care Act would be repealed and replaced essentially simultaneously. The president-elect said that he would place his business interests in a trust and transfer control of his company to his two adult sons. And the German economy expanded at 1.9% in 2016, the fastest pace in 5 years, up from 2015's 1.7% pace. The government ended the year with 6.2 billion euros budget surplus. German exports hit a record in November, rising 2.5% versus a year earlier. Forecasts for 2017 call for a slight decline in the German growth rate, with estimates ranging from 1.1 to 1.7%. And the Bank of England Governor Mike Carney this week said that Brexit is no longer the biggest single risk to financial stability in the United Kingdom. That's a dramatic change in tune from the nation's top central banker. Before the referendum in June, Carney warned of severe economic consequences if Britons voted to leave the European Union. Now Carney says that the bank will very likely revise its economic forecast higher next month. The EU, Carney said, has more to lose from a hard Brexit than the UK. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up on KGMI. We'll be back shortly after a little short break.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning. We are Asset Advisors, located out in the Pacific Commerce Center. That's out on the Pacific Highway next to Wilson's Furniture. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101. That's Ferndale, 98248. Our phone number, 360-733-1200. Check out our website at assetadvisorsllc.net. And give us a call again, 733-1200, if you got questions for us. Love to meet with you. Love to work with you. Maybe get out of this cold weather, make it a little bit nicer around here, I hope. So anyway, retail sales in December. The U.S. consumer is doing fine, with the first estimate of December retail sales coming in very close to consensus expectations. Nothing very surprising to this report. Auto sales were strong, which we already knew from automakers' unit sales reports last week. Gas station sales were strong, which we knew based on higher gas prices. And non-store sales were up briskly, which we saw from all those package deliveries throughout December. General merchandise stores lost ground, which is consistent with recent headlines, like the Limited shutting its 250 stores. A decade ago, general merchandise stores made 51% of sales through non-store activities. Now non-store retail equals a record 89% of sales at those same merchandisers. Expect that trend to continue in the years ahead. The one potential surprise is that restaurants and bars had a weak December, with sales down 0.8%. We wouldn't be surprised to see that figure revised upwards in the months ahead. Overall sales are up 4.1% in the past year, and we expect that trend to accelerate. Sales are up 5.2% annual rate in the last 6 months and a 6% rate in the last 3 months. And although core sales, which exclude autos, building materials, and gas, were unchanged in December, it's not unusual for even these sales to take a breather month a few times per year. Consumers are in relatively good shape. Job growth continues, wage gains are accelerating, and consumer debt service obligations are very low by historical standards. In other news, new claims for jobless claims increased 10,000 last week to a still modest 247,000. Continuing claims dropped 29,000 to 2.09 million. We also saw inventory surge 0.7% in November, which is the largest gain in any month since 2015. So plugging all this data into our GDP models expects real GDP grew around 2% annual rate in the fourth quarter, consistent with the plowless growth we've seen since the recovery started in mid-2009. But we're going to watch for better policies and faster growth in 2017. We also had the producer price index come out this week. Their prices rose to nearly every category in December, finishing 2016 with the largest calendar year increase in producer prices going back to 2012. Good prices led the index higher in December, rising 0.7% on the back of a 2.6% jump in energy prices. Since bottoming in early 2016, energy prices have been a tailwind, pushing goods price steadily higher following more than 18 months of near constant declines. Meanwhile, service prices have shown consistent, if moderate, inflation. We expect this trend to continue in 2017, pushing overall inflation towards and eventually above the Fed's 2% inflation target. So stripping out the volatile food and energy categories, core producer prices rose 0.2% in December and increased 1.6% in 2016, which is a significant pickup from the 0.2% increase in 2015. This data, paired with continued gains in employment, puts the Fed on track for 3 or maybe 4 rate hikes in 2017. In other recent inflation news, import prices rose 0.4% in December and are up 1.8% from a year ago. Petroleum import prices jumped 7.9% in December, following November's 3% decline. And while the long decline in energy prices that began in mid-2014 appears to be over, don't be surprised if we see fits and starts on the road higher. Export prices also rose in December, up 0.3%, and have increased 1.1% in the last year. The Fed has plenty of inflation indicators to watch as leadership changes in Washington and new policies are put in place. But as things currently stand, inflation appears to have greater potential for an upside surprise than a return to the near zero pace of inflation seen as recently as late 2015. A little bit more detail on some of these reports. Retail sales were up 0.6%, but it was flat if you exclude cars and gas. The consensus estimate was for retail sales to grow 0.7% overall and expand 0.3% excluding autos and fuels. What does all this mean? Well, the report is disappointing on two levels. Cutting through all the hype of confident consumer spending and with abandon at the end of last year, retail sales proves that it just didn't happen. We might feel a bit better about future, but we still have the same jobs with the same income and the same circle of health care costs and retirement funding that we can't square. And the part of the report that showed growth, auto sales, comes with a caveat. Automakers are now offering the same level of incentives that they did back in the mid-2000s, in addition to stretching payments for 5, 6, and even 7 years. They are essentially being bribing consumers to buy cars. And then the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now forecast for the fourth quarter recently ticked up at 2.9%. I expect it to drop based on disappointing retail sales. We'll get the same estimate of the fourth quarter GDP in the last week of January. We saw the U.S. Senate vote to allow partial repeal of the Affordable Care Act by simple majority. Of course, we saw the same thing in the House, where the Senate voted to include the repeal in some parts of the ACA through budget reconciliation, which requires 51 votes. What does this mean? Well, this is the first step in repealing the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Some people are upset that the Senate and likely House would use budget reconciliation to make such a move. And it's worth remembering that this is how we got the ACA in the first place. In 2010, the Senate used budget reconciliation to pass the landmark legislation with a simple majority of 51 votes. The big question is, what comes next? And while there are several competing plans from Republicans, including detailed plans from Representatives Price and Ryan, so far neither congressional Republicans or the incoming administration have put forth a comprehensive blueprint for future legislation. It could take months before such a document emerges, which means we should expect a lot of lofty claims and loud laments between now and then. We saw mortgage purchase applications down 8% from last year, so home buyers appear cautious in response to higher rates since last fall. What does this mean? Well, last September, home buyers could get a 30-year loan at 3.65%. Today, that number has jumped to 4.3%. In the grand scheme of things, snagging a loan for 30 years at less than 5% is a fabulous deal. But it sure looks bad when compared with recent history. It's too soon to tell if the housing market will slow down appreciably due to slightly higher rates. We'll have to get into the prime selling season this spring before we know for sure. But on a related note, real estate company Trulia was just reported that failed sales, where contracts are signed but not completed, almost doubled in the fourth quarter of 2015 to 4.3% in the same period last year. We also seen the yuan weaken back near 7 U.S. per dollar. After strengthening to 6.75 per dollar, the yuan dropped again, nearing the psychological important 7 per dollar level. What does it mean? Well, Chinese officials are struggling to keep their currency from crashing. Having spent nearly $1 trillion to stem the tide of capital flowing out of their country, they now rely on a host of capital controls. It's not working. Consumers, business owners, and investors want to convert their cash to dollars and euros before the yuan falls further, and they're doing their best to circumvent the new currency rules. In the last week, the Chinese government announced new rules aimed at people using Bitcoin to move cash. The announcement sent Bitcoin down another 10% following its 20% dive the week before. Government's efforts won't work. As the Chinese economy slows down, capital will seek higher returns. I still think yuan will fall, which means go above 7 per dollar in the near future. Costs $233,000 to raise a child. The U.S. Department of Agriculture released its 2015 cost estimate for raising one child from birth to 17 in the United States. The figure included shelter, food, transportation, and child care, among other things, but does not include college costs. What it means, There are a few things, big things to note about this report. Almost $250,000 is a lot of money, but it's actually $12,000 less than the 2015 total. Child care costs are growing, which is no surprise to parents with young kids. And while having kids is expensive, the numbers aren't as bad as they seem. A full 29% of the cost goes to shelter. For those of us who own our homes, this isn't exactly an expense item. It's more like an investment, since we get to keep the asset after the kids leave. Okay, Chicago Mayor Emanuel pressures rating agency Moody's to lift the city's junk rating. Before the city issues $1.2 billion in new debt, the mayor wants Moody's to upgrade its rating so that Chicago will pay less interest. What does this mean? Well, give the mayor props for audacity. Although Chispath seems more appropriate. Chicago might have raised taxes a bit, but the city still has a $5.4 billion deficit when it only generates $9 billion in revenues. That's like spending $144,000 a year when you only have $90,000 and then being mad when a credit card company turns down your application. The city's pensions are underfunded by $22 billion with a funding level of just 31%. If recent history in Detroit and Puerto Rico have taught us anything, it's that investors holding Chicago's general obligation debt are about to be robbed of their investments, and Moody's is right to hold the line. Chicago general obligation bonds are junk. They just haven't been taken to the dump yet. And next week, the week of January 16th includes economic reports of consumer prices and housing starts. The week ends with the presidential inauguration on Friday. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be back after news and sports. Thank you for listening. Welcome to Wealth Wake Up. This is Dick Donahue with you here on KGMI. Thank you for being with us. Boy, the Seahawks sure had a rough afternoon yesterday, didn't they? Ben Carson's prescription, get people off of government assistance. Retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson appeared before the U.S. Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Thursday to share his vision for the Department of Housing and Urban Development if the Senate confirms him as its next secretary. In early December, President-elect Donald Trump announced Carson, who is a rival contender for the White House, as his pick to head HUD. There are four highlights of Carson's appearance. One, on government assistance. At the hearing, Republican Senator Tom Tillis questioned Carson about his vision of best serving those who are in government programs. What is the best possible thing we can do for somebody who is on a government assistance, the North Carolina senator asked. Get them off of it, Carson responded. Then he was asked about his childhood experience. Carson said in a written statement that growing up in the inner city of Detroit with a single mother who had a third grade education allowed him to understand housing insecurity. Carson credited his mother for teaching him the importance of personal responsibility and said that if confirmed as the next Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, he would do more than just advance his programs and funding. And then third, he says, let's put medical clinics in neighborhoods. Basically what he said is Carson said that as part of his effort to enable and serve the beneficiaries of HUD programs, he plans to potentially put medical clinics in neighborhoods so that people don't rely on emergency room where it costs five times more and where you don't get rid or get the kind of follow-up that would prevent you from having stage 5 renal disease. And then number four, he says, work to benefit all Americans. Senator Elizabeth Warren, good old Elizabeth Warren, you know, that Democrat from Massachusetts, she asked Carson about his intentions to ensure that none of the money funneled through HUD would specifically benefit Trump's real estate ties. My concern is whether or not among billions of dollars that you'll be responsible for handing out in grants and loans, can you assure us that not one dollar, will go to the benefit of either the president-elect or his family, Warren asked. Carson responded by saying this work would be the benefit to all Americans, not just the select few. It will not be my intention to do anything to benefit any American particularly. Carson said it's for all Americans, everything that we do. And talking some more about government, Kentucky's right-to-work earthquake is going to reverberate across state lines. Kentucky's government, Matt Bevin, a Republican, has now officially signed right-to-work legislation, along with other jobs legislation, into law. Yet the impact of Kentucky's right-to-work legislation could move beyond the state's borders. Right-to-work laws prohibit employers from entering into agreements that make union membership and payment of union dues a condition of employment. Additionally, Bevin signed the Paycheck Protection Act, which calls on workers to opt in if they want union dues withheld from their paychecks, instead of requiring workers to opt out if they don't want their union dues withheld. And the other big-ticket item eliminates the prevailing wage employers must now pay on work funded for public money. This involves construction work on schools and government buildings. And these laws could have a significant impact on the national debate over worker freedom. Kentucky is poised to become the 27th right-to-work state. Promises made, promises kept. That's how Kentucky State Representative Jason Names, representative from Louisville, describes the successful push for right-to-work legislation that went down in last Saturday's special session of his state's General Assembly. Names was elected in November along with a Republican wave that delivered the Kentucky House of Representatives to his party in the first time since 1921. I'm calling it Promises Made, Promises Kept because we ran our worker freedom. We ran on the right to work. We ran on paycheck protection and on repealing the prevailing wage law. We delivered in just the first week of the new General Assembly, is what he said in a phone interview. These votes for to right to work were about economic development and about making our state more competitive, he said. But it isn't just about economic development. Right to work is also about the liberty and freedom of association. Someone shouldn't be forced to join an organization just to put food on the table. And Kentucky labor unions, which held loud and boisterous protests in and around the State House throughout the week and into Saturday, remained ardently opposed to the legislation the governor was set to sign in law. One of the local unions, Local 2164, United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 7227, and Kentucky State AFL-CIO were among the unions that expressed strong opposition to the Right to Work bill and other labor-related bills that passed. They don't want to work for the working man, and it's sad but true that they want to fight unions every way they can fight us. And that came from Monica Williams, who was president of one of the unions. The unions are good for people, not just unions, is what she said. That's unfortunate. Fortunately, Williams added, because unions deliver social and economic benefits and Republicans' critics overlook. Well, what happened in Kentucky is not necessarily going to stay in Kentucky. That's because the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers the districts of Kentucky, Michigan, Tennessee, and Ohio, issued a ruling in November that upheld the right of localities to pass right-to-work ordinances in the absence of state-level legislation. So the action began in Warren County, Kentucky, in the fall of 2014, with 11 other counties following suit. And the Kentucky counties argued that because the federal government was already authorized states to pass right-to-work laws, it follows that counties are also permitted to pass right-to-work since they are creations of the state. Therefore, the counties argued local right-to-work ordinances are permissible unless a state legislative body explicitly forbids them. So Jim Waters, who's president of the Bluegrass Institute, which is a libertarian free market think tank in Kentucky, said in a phone interview that Warren County's decision to press ahead with its own ordinance certainly had an impact on whatever happened statewide. What this means is we'll no longer watch jobs and opportunities to fly over our head and around our state, he said. Waters pointed out Kentucky's largest border is with Tennessee, which is a right-to-work state. And four of Kentucky's seven neighboring states are right-to-work, Indiana, Tennessee, Virginia, and West Virginia. He said $1 billion in capital investment has gone into Warren County since it passed right to work in December of 2014. He said, yes, that's a B with a billion. These are not prospects. These are our commitments. And when legislators in other parts of the state saw what was happening in Warren County, they certainly took notice. I'm not saying it was a factor in determining what happened statewide, but it certainly was a factor. I mean, anytime you can bring in $1 billion in investment for new business, that's a lot. Waters also said there are 55 25,000 new job openings in a 50-mile radius where Warren County passed its right-to-work ordinance. And that's not a coincidence, he said. He said, I do believe our county government initiative advanced the Kentucky legislative effort as it created a public awareness and helped to educate citizens about right-to-work throughout the state. The Warren County judge executive sent an email that the entire state was amazed at the remarkable increase in the prospects that contracted Warren County immediately after they passed right to work. And then he added, this is again, the county judge executive said, Kentucky is a great place for business, but the fact that we were the only state in the Southeast U.S. that was not right to work kept us from being considered for a site for new locations by growing industries. Site selections and selectors had told us that as many as 75% of the clients instructed them to eliminate any state that wasn't right to work. That left Kentucky off the list of consideration right from the beginning. You know, why am I spending time talking about this Sunday morning? Because Washington is not a right-to-work state. So think about it. So right now, the work is passed. The state's legislature has posted a sign over the door that says Kentucky is open for business. Now, this could have an impact on a number of other states, too, because we're seeing quite a bit of movement in a number of states, and we think there's potential to see at least three or four more legislatures pass legislation this year. Missouri is one of them. There's also talk of a couple of the other states in the country passing it. So they're looking at the potential of up to 30 or 31 states being right to work by the end of this upcoming legislative session that we're seeing come into effect right now. So anyway, Dick Donahue with you. I know Minnesota and Pennsylvania are also under that, as well as New Hampshire and Montana. So anyway, Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning with Wealth Wake Up on KGMI. We'll be back after a short break. Thank you for listening.
Because there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning. Again, if you got questions for us, don't be afraid to give us a call, 733-1200. You know, I covered one of these on last week's show. Another one came up this week. Seven ways a senator says government wastes your tax dollars. So as Congress enters the debate on a new budget, Senator Jeff Flake, Republican of Arizona, is making sure wasteful spending remains at the forefront with a report citing examples ranging from a study of how college students party to research on whether dinosaurs could sing. How's that one? He said they released the report Wastebook, Porking on Go for two reasons. One is to inform the debate that being right now about whether we should bring earmarking back, Flake said. And two, just the issue of priorities. We have to make choices when we're borrowing a lot of money. Named after the wild popular mobile game Pokemon Go, Wastebook Pokemon Go released Tuesday details more than $5 billion in what Flake calls wasteful government spending. The report is the second volume of the Arizona Republicans' Wastebook series. Flake has a habit of exposing government waste. In 2015, he released a detailed report entitled Wastebook, The Farce Awakens, and has put out similar reports since 2003 when he was in the House. Here are seven of the most outrageous examples detailed in the new Wastebook report. Number one, Spaceport to Nowhere. The Missile Defense Agency continues to fund a rocket launch site in Alaska that could cost the organization up to $80.4 million. The facility is 20 years old, rarely used, and established with an $18 million earmark. The millions spent to date on this launch complex have not made America safer from potential missile attacks from foreign adversaries, the report states. To the contrary, it has siphoned away tens of millions of dollars that could have been better spent on more promising initiatives. Number two, fishes on a treadmill. This is a beauty. How long can a mud skipper use a treadmill? The University of California San Diego Scripps Institution of Oceanography is using grant money from the National Science Foundation to answer just that. The study found that mud skippers can exercise longer and recover quicker under higher oxygen concentrations. The grant also is slated to be used to purchase what one of the researchers jokingly refers to as all the toys, as well as travel costs for junkets and conferences. And then there's number three, holograms at a comedy museum. The National Comedy Center, which is a nonprofit in New York, received $1.7 million grant from the Department of Commerce's Economic Development Administration to create a comedy museum. The museum will feature holograms of dead comedians. The New York State lawmaker has promised to bring an additional $3 million in federal funding. I'm not kidding you, Flake said. It's a comedy club that unfortunately gets your tax dollars. Number four was partying college students. Boy, somebody's getting me turned around here. Part of the $5 million grant from a section of the National Institutes of Health paid for a researcher at Brown University to study the partying habits of college students. Some findings: Greek members engaged in more risky health behaviors than non-Greek members. The college students tend to increase their intake of alcohol on game days, according to the researchers, Flake said, and all the games had the same goal, causing the participants to become intoxicated. I think this falls into the obnoxious category. And number five, do boys and girls play more with dolls? A study executed by Vanderbilt University with money from the National Eye Institute and National Science Foundation examined whether boys or girls spend more time playing with Barbie dolls. The report surveyed about 300 men and women and cost over $300,000. The study also found, in the words of Flake, reported that women were much better at identifying the correct Barbies, while men were more likely to recognize the Transformers. Singing dinosaurs. Study concluded with partial funding from $450,000 in grants from the National Science Foundation examined whether dinosaurs were able to sing. The two-year study examined in part whether dinosaurs ever possessed a syrinx. And the lead author said the study was another important step to figuring out what dinosaurs sounded like. And number seven, binge-watching computers. Can computers learn human behavior by binge-watching TV shows as The Office and Desperate Housewives? The study was funded in part by the Department of Defense's Office of Naval Research and National Science Foundation, which helped researchers study how TV shows train computers to understand the human behavior. Flake said he sees this research is nonsensical. Spending nearly $500 million to turn computers into couch potatoes doesn't compute to me, he said. Okay, and then using the house to pay for grandma. I've always got the nagging feeling that I'm not saving enough for retirement, maybe because sometimes we wonder how much is really enough. I know most Americans are in the same boat, and to top it off, Social Security is going broke since more than 30% of the retirees count on Social Security for 90% or more of their monthly income. That's a huge problem. But when it comes to financing retirement, at least we're not Chinese. In the U.S., Social Security will exhaust sometime in the early 2030s. At that point, the program will bring in enough funds to pay roughly 75% of the promised benefits, leaving an average annual benefit of around $200 billion. To fix this, we'll have to raise taxes, cut benefits, or some combination of the two. China's pension scheme will be underfunded by $116 trillion by 2015, will steadily get worse after that. The government currently has no plans on how to fix their problem, but a wealthy real estate magnate does. He's president of China's largest state-owned property developer. Instead of trying to wring new taxes out of the system, he proposes the Chinese retirees take out reverse mortgages on their homes. These allow homeowners to take out loans against the equity that they build in their homes in the form of monthly payments that last until they die, sell, or move. At that point, the total of the payments plus interest are repaid using the equity of the home. But since the Chinese hold 76% of their personal net wealth in real estate, it only makes sense to tap this asset for retirement income. One problem: to make such a program work, there must be new buyers in the years to come and to keep home values up. Currently, China has 1.3 billion people with big aging population bulges in the 45 to 49 range, and then they have the 25 to 29 range. Younger age groups are markedly smaller because of the one-child policy over the last 35 years. Demographers, optimistically project that the country's population is to remain flat and a drop by 300,000 people from 2050 to 2090. As I said, this is optimistic. So today's Chinese women have an average of 1.6 children. It takes two children from both parents to totally, keep your system level. By holding families to one child, the Chinese government inadvertently created a system where parents compete for everything for their children with slots at university to spouses. All that fighting takes cash, so having more than one child would be quite a financial burden. If couples stay on their current track of having few children, then the rosy projections of a state population will fade and the number of Chinese will dwindle even faster than anticipated. Among the weird incomes of the falling population will be fewer homebuyers. So fewer homebuyers are going to lead to lower prices. And this is going to hurt the reverse mortgage industry. Now, in the U.S., we're pretty much even. So we don't quite have the problem. I'm going to run out of time here. But in the end, there is a problem. As populations age, the citizens translate from net producers to net consumers. Unless there are more workers that provide more goods and service and pay taxes, or older citizens have stored up enormous amount of wealth, it'll be almost impossible for the elderly population to maintain its standard of living. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up this Sunday morning here on KGMI. Thank you for listening, and don't forget our live show on Saturdays at 11. Questions for us, give us a call, 733-1200. Have a good week, and again, thank you for listening.